at the end we talked about the distributed execution model, where we basically looked at a logical clock and not the physical clock, and which basically gave us the possibility to provide an ordering with respect to the events happening not just within a single environment, but also across multiple machines or multiple environments. And we had two ways to realize that. The one was basically just a counter, the scalar values, which was exchanged between the involved machines or involved components of the distributed application. And features or the characteristic, it was not strict consistent, the vector, the scalar clock. But then we had also what we call these vector clocks, where every component got basically an entry in a vector, and therefore in that sense we could now individually increase or count the events happening at a local component. And then it was possible basically to see what the progress with respect to events is in the various components of a distributed application. A vector clock is strict consistent. That means if the vector clock is larger for an event compared to a second event, then we know that the first event comes later than the second event. And therefore, in that sense, from the vector clock, we can also derive information about the ordering of the events. But it's still, the vector clocks is not a total ordering of events. Therefore, there are still the possibility that we have concurrency. That means events happening in parallel involving multiple machines or multiple environments. Where these events play a role is also in the context of failure handling, as we will see a little bit later. And first, look at the motivation. Certainly, with failures, we have the situation that, on one hand, we can handle that by a programmer-defined exception handling routine. And in that sense, the application basically stops in a controlled way or continues at a definite or a programmer-defined place within the program. Therefore, in that sense, especially if you look at local applications, if you have no handling, that's, as you know, in a Unix environment, you end up with a core dump, and the operating system basically closes all the open files, and it will clean up the environment. So here, clean up environment. And on the other hand, you can have the exception handling, where basically the application can be stopped in a controlled manner, or the application will continue in a way as the programmer intends it to do after certain errors occur. If we have a distributed application, certainly we have also these failures in the local components. But also what we have additionally are these communication link failures. That means here wires, bridges, or routers are not functioning correctly, or routers or bridges are overloaded and they start to throw messages away. And the other situation is here the following, that here we have crashes of machines where individual components run. And if we look at it, when we have a client-server application, the client can crash and the server basically waits for RPC calls of the crashed client. If there was never any communication, then it's not really a problem. But if it's a RPC interaction which already consists of multiple RPC, then basically it could be that the server reserved resources, and now because it does not get any connection from the client, it might still reserve the resources and not release them. On the other hand, we might have a situation that the server crashes, the client can either not connect to the server, or the client could connect and then send the request, but then it waits for the answer, and in the meantime the server crashed and never answers. These failures, they are rather straightforward, and we could, especially with these environments, client and server crashes, we could handle basically also with standby subsystems or redundancy. Also here, redundancy would be a possibility to handle that. The other thing is, which is a lot more complicated, are these Byzantine failures, and these, I mean, these arbitrary failures. And therefore, in that sense, sometimes the environment works correctly and everything is fine, and then a little bit later, it's not working correctly, and especially that it would send wrong answers, which might be still in the range of expected answers, and that's very difficult then to detect for the client, but it would still be wrong. And therefore, in that sense, Byzantine failures are not a really nice thing, a really bad thing, because they are very difficult to detect, and especially if you have these temporary failures which might be caused by some kind of temperature, that it's too hot in the machine, where you have this arbitrary behavior, and especially if they are still in the range of expected or tolerated answers, then it's very difficult to detect wrong answers. Failure-prone RPC interfaces, that's easier to detect, because the client would try to contact the server and it does not work. It just gets an error message back. And therefore, in that sense, it's not a problem. Or you could have bugs on the distributed subsystem. That means on the protocols and so on. And certainly, that's not really not related to the distributed application, but it might affect also other applications. And they are certainly here easier to detect than these Byzantine failures. We can look at the steps for testing a distributed application, and that's something like a three-phase or three-step approach. In the first step, you would basically have the distributed application and link it to a single application. So here, link it to a single application, if it's possible. And therefore, in that sense, you eliminate all the communication parts. You would be able to test the component functionality, but on the other hand, look at all the features, the functionality works. But what you don't really consider is asynchronousness. That means that delay when you have a communication across network. You don't really have parallelism. Because if you consider a single machine, everything runs more or less sequentially. And also time is not taken into the consideration. And you would think of it, an RPC, a remote procedure call, would basically become a local procedure call. And therefore, you would not have the situation that part of the application crashes and part of the application continues on. If I have a single application, either the whole application goes away or the whole application is up and running. The next step of testing, you would use a local communication. Therefore, in that sense, you would have components as separate processes. So here the components are separate processes. And therefore, in that sense, they are actually separate. They don't use the shared memory. They have completely separate memory, but you use local communication, and that's something like inter-process communication. One possibility would be to send it out the send line of the network card, and then immediately get it back, something like a loop back on the receive line. And therefore, in that sense, you have a real communication between involved processes, but what you don't consider is network transport times. And also not any problems with respect to routers or things like that, which might be in between a network link or a network path from the sender to the receiver. And time predictions, in a sense, time predictions with respect to the processes, but without considering transport times. And also, especially if you would have something like multi-core architecture, you could also have a real parallelism between the different involved components. And there also you could take care of the events, like sending event comes before the receiving event and so on. And the last test would be here basically to take the application, take all the components, and now also consider network-wide communication. And also you can look at time dependencies, which consider network times. You can have sequential and parallel execution of components, and also you could check and work with multiple clients. And even this test, step 3, could be tested in two variants. The one would be possible to build something like a test environment at the software house, where you test it locally and across the network. But it's basically the network of the programming company. But then you could also have a second other test at the customer side, and to basically look at the network delays at the customer side and see how if the application still still continues to work correctly. And therefore you see already the point is that you try to eliminate most of the functionality problems already here or in the second step. And then basically deal mostly with timing problems. Timing problems could happen in a way that you have a client here, you have the network in between, and you have a second client here, I mean C1, C2, and then you have a server here, and they send requests, and then you would have something like the buffer where the requests are basically stored, and if you have a lot of or multiple clients sending the requests very fast, you could have a buffer overflow and situation which never happens at test 1 or test 2. And therefore, in that sense, you come and consider new failure situations which usually don't really occur here, or you have to deal with the situation that you have a huge delay here, send one request here, forget to mark requests with different identifiers, and then basically run into problems because then the answers come delayed and you have a mismatch between requests and answers. Therefore, there are a whole bunch of problems which you discover here, and most of the functionality problems or typical program errors which you know from a local application you want to eliminate already here. The next thing would be debugging. How do you do actually debugging of a distributed application? And if you think of debuggers, you have something like static debugging, and a possibility here is you don't really do a program execution, but you do something like code inspection. And that's very common actually before you release your software, that usually you have a completely different group of so-called code inspectors, which then try to read your program code. And if they don't understand certain things, basically the programmers have to come and then explain what they wanted to do. And on the other hand, it also requires from the programmers to program, let's say, code inspector friendly. In that sense, like, how do you name variables? How do you use names of procedures? How do you use comments and so on? Therefore, they have to put a lot of focus on that type of thing because the code inspectors wants to read that. The other thing is that's other possibility. What you know is dynamic debugging, and that approach is you use program execution, and then you use, let's say, breakpoints. You use things that you modify variables. You'll have the possibility of single stepping or of stepping, let's say, larger global steps going through various procedures and so on, that you don't do a single step within the procedure, but basically a step from procedure to procedure. You have a whole bunch of variations. And the point here is if you look at the thing, a distributed application, what static debugging, that's okay, because then you can look at the code, the program code of the various components and go through. The problem is you have so much influence from other components that it's very difficult to keep track of it. The other thing is, like the dynamic debugging. And if you think of it, well, if I do a breakpoint at a server code and inspect my local variables, that might cause a timeout on the client side, because that waits for the answer of its request. It doesn't get it within a short time. And because you as a programmer look at the code or at the variables, and then it times out and possibly repeats the sending of requests. Therefore, in that sense, inspecting one component might cause a lot of side effects to the other components. Well, what can we debug? What can we look at? Certainly, we could look at the communication between components, and we could look at the message flow. It would be better, or usually what we look at it is messages on the application layer. So here, messages of application layer. And you don't really want to look at the MAC layer and look at what kind of MAC messages go back and forth. Or you don't really want to look at the TCP or IP layer and look at IP messages. What you want to look at is basically here the application layer, not the transport or IP layer. And you can have situations in a way of inserting messages or capturing messages sent from, if you look at here too, the client and the server, and then you do a debugger, and then you could say, well, the messages go in here, and then they go out again. Then you can inspect here the messages. You can even inject new messages and send it to the server, or you could interact with the client and say, well, here you inject response messages and just see how the request messages come in. Therefore, in that sense, you have the possibility of inserting, deleting, manipulating messages going between the components. Snapshots. Well, it's usually when you look at a snapshot in a local application, you'd look at memory. Here, in a distributed application, you don't have a shared memory, and you don't have any clock synchronization, strict clock synchronization. And therefore, it's very difficult to get a consistent state. So here, difficult to get consistent application state. And the question is, what is the application state at all? And we can look at it and see the state of the entire system. It's basically the local states of all the components, as well as the messages which are still on the way in the network, going back and forth. And the local states, that's very easy to order them according to the local events. But now the events across the network, we would then need something like the event ordering as we heard it with the happened before relation, either using vector clocks or the scalar clocks. Breakpoints and single stepping. Well, do you do a distributed breakpoint, one breakpoint, and then stop at all components? Or single stepping, what does it mean? Do you do a step in each component, a single step, or do you do a single step in one component and all the other components run freely? and or do you do something like a distributed single step? The non-determinism, that's certainly coming due to variations of transmission times, also here due to variation of transmission times. And or network delays, and therefore in that sense it's very difficult to reproduce an error. It could happen that at some point it works fine, and at some point you have a problem. And for example, if you look at here a client and the server, and here's the network, and here this one sends always the requests going into the buffer and then handling. And if, for example, if you have a certain load on the network, then the transmission is so slow that actually the buffer, the server can handle all the requests. They come at something like a slow rate. But then, if you don't really have any load on the network, if it's completely empty, then possibly it could happen that you have a buffer overflow and then some error failure situations on the server side, because now the requests from all the clients coming much too fast. And that's one of the things where you have a transmission of or a variation of transmission times. And the other thing is, as I already mentioned before, the interference of debugger and distributed application. If I debug that here, I slow down this here, but this one still runs at high speed. Or I debug the client, this one runs at high speed, but it's not a problem because it just waits for requests, and therefore if I slow down this here, the server always has enough time to handle the requests, and therefore it never runs into any problems. And in that sense, the interference makes it much harder to do dynamic debugging. What you often find is monitoring of components, as I mentioned here. And then you would have something here like a local debugger. And this local debugger is separate. And when you do the debugging here, then you could have also from the communication debugger, you could answer the requests from these other components immediately and basically have some well-defined default answers. And therefore, in that sense, these ones could still work and without the debugging. And for that, you could then use slowly inject here these requests and see how this component works here. The other thing is, when we look at it, a global breakpoint. Oh, I missed the thing. If we look at a global breakpoint, what is a global breakpoint? And a global breakpoint means you stop. You have a breakpoint at all involved components. And the breakpoint is not something like the time when you stop it. You basically look at the ordering of events. Also here, it's based on the events, and you look at the ordering of the events. When we talked about we said the events are partially ordered. They are not totally ordered, they are partially ordered. And we can either use these scalar clocks or these vector clocks to order the events. And what happens here, if you look at it, T1 is a send event, T11 to component 2. This is a receive event. That's a send event. That's a receive event. Here we have a send event. Here we have a receive event. Here we have a send event. Here we have a receive event. And we can say here T12 and T23 are concurrent. And T32 and T12, they are ordered. And therefore, in that sense, we have a ordering depending on the message exchange. And the point is now, how do we handle now a distributed breakpoint? And if we look at the next figure, we have here the situation that we say, well, we want to stop. This is our breakpoint at T12. That's where we stop. And then basically we have to roll back to the earliest possible consistent state. And after the last event being in the before relationship with the triggered event. Therefore, what we look at it, which event happened on component 2, which has a before relationship with T12. Here we have two events, two T3, then T22 and T21. With respect to T23, that's concurrent. There's no before relationship. We basically have to go back to T22 and have that as a before. Then what's with component 3? We have to look at the same thing again. Here, that's rather easier because this is a receive event. That's a send event. We basically go back to the send event. And that's basically with this one, we can't because there's no relationship between these two events. We have to find an event which is in a before relationship. And we take the latest one and not going roll back to 3T31. And that means here all components are stopped. As you hear, all components are stopped. And now you could go ahead and inspect component 1, inspect component 2, and component 3, and see what their state with respect to the variables is. If you look at implementations of distributed debuggers, most of the distributed debuggers were some research projects and not really any commercial products. There are a few which are available, like IBM iDebug is one. It's a multi-platform debugger. It's also used to debug, as you hear, debug web-based applications. And in that sense, to debug web servers and web services, and also like servlets, but also Java server pages and so on. And it also allows you to debug Java Enterprise Beans. And in that sense, it's a distributed debugger which can support the programmer. Very often what is used is the equivalent of printfs. And the programmer just includes in the programming code printfs and logs all the things happening locally at the component, and then they check the log and see what was the history until a certain era appeared. The next thing, what we will look at it, is something like distributed transactions in this here. And the intention is to somewhat take the transaction approach, what you know from databases, to interact from a client side with a database server and then bundle database operations into a single transaction, and then have the and then have the ACID behavior. And we also want to have something similar on with the client-server interaction. And the intention for these distributed transactions is something like to have a reliable and fault-tolerant distributed transactions which use shared data concurrently. The point is here, you can set up a transaction and then you have these RPCs, for example, and these are requests to different servers. And the point here is that the one client, and a very simple thing would be the situation that you have a client, you have the server of a bank B1 and the server of a bank B2, and what you want to have is, from the client side, it would basically wants to have the transfer of money from one account to another account here. And that's basically done as two operations. One is here the operation to deduct the account, to decrease the account, here to increase the account. And what you don't really want to have as a customer, that here you decrease it, but then somehow this operation fails and you can't increase the account from where it should go, the money, and therefore the money would basically be lost here, and nobody knows then if that bank or this bank has the amount. Or we have the other situation that here this one would increase the account, but this account is not decreased and the money is still on your account. Well, from a customer side, that would be advantageous. From the bank side, it's probably not there in their interest. And in that sense, you have now these two operations and they have to be bundled into a transaction. Either both are successful or none is successful. And that means you have here the same situation, the ACID property, as we know it from databases, atomicity, either all operations are successful or none. And in that sense, if they are successful, they have the side effect, or if they are aborted, they have no consequence. Durability, we want to have the same situation. The results of a transaction have to be persistent. That means if this server crashes, all the result of the transaction must be preserved. Even if you have a system failure. Isolation, you have the same situation as databases. You have multiple requests from clients all interacting with the servers, and you have the situation that multiple RPCs and requests come in, and they have to be somewhat put into sequence that they come out in a correct way, that in one sense, if they are executed concurrently, then they are not allowed to influence each other, or they are basically executed in sequence. And the consistency, certainly if you start a transaction, you have a consistent state. If you commit or abort the transaction, again, you have a consistent state. You might have something like intermediary states, which might be not consistent. But the final start and the final states are consistent. The one thing what we also would have is something like nested transactions or flat transactions. Flat is basically here you would have all requests on the same level, just in a sequence. Nested means you have a transaction within a transaction. And in that sense, and you could have the situation that this server does not deal with the request itself. It might cause something like sub-requests. And these sub-requests might be part of a sub-transaction. And therefore, in that sense, when this server has to commit or abort the transaction, then it has to find out if the sub-transactions can actually commit or have to be aborted. Therefore, in that sense, the commit and abort might cause a lot of sub-transaction interaction and checking if an abort is necessary or an commit could be done. We can look at a few aspects now of the transaction, like isolation and how isolation could be done. And one of the things is that isolation refers to a serializability of transactions, even if they are possibly executed in parallel. But it could be that also you could serialize them. If you serialize them and you have two transactions, U and T, and two involved servers, R and S, then it means if they are executed in the sequence R before T, then this sequence must also apply to S. So here, R before T, and it means the sequence is relevant for all servers. So here, sequence relevant for all servers. And that might be necessary, for example, to have a consistent state. And it has to be done on all involved servers. And the point is here that U uses the two servers R and S, and T uses the two servers R and S. If U uses only R and T uses only S, then that's not anything we have to look at it. Because could be done in any sequence, because there's no side effect with respect to the order, because one works on one server, the other one works on the other server. The possibility when you can do isolation is you could use timestamp ordering. And if you have a single server transaction, certainly you can assign a unique timestamp, and that's basically the timestamp when the transaction starts, and when you have multiple transactions, you can use the timestamp to order the transactions. The transaction with the earlier timestamp basically comes earlier. If you have a distributed transaction, that would mean the timestamp is triggered by the first or decided the by the first server. So here decided by first server, and here you might have different server IDs, because if you have the situation U and T, you have the server R and S. This one starts here, this one starts here, then you get the ID from for U, you get from here, ID U, and then it has the interaction with this here, then T would get the ID from S, and then it would get the interaction with this one. Therefore, in that sense, you might get the server part, the server ID from different servers. And also, the timestamp comes once from this here, and a timestamp comes once from that here. And therefore, in that sense, if the clocks are not synchronized, this one might be a little bit earlier, this one might be a little bit late. Therefore, in that sense, we have some kind of skew between the clocks here and clock here. What we want is not to have an accurate way of saying this transaction comes before that transaction. That's not really what we want. The only thing what we want is that we can decide on this and on this machine and on that machine when we do an ordering of the transactions, that we can decide which transaction comes before what, before another transaction. That we could decide U before T or T before U. That's the question. And that's the question here on R, and that's the question here on S. And if we basically have a local timestamp here and the server ID, the local timestamp here on S, and even if this one is slow, the clock, and I and T would get an earlier timestamp, you could use that as a decision to see, to say, okay, T is before U. Even if from your physical clock, U was before T actually on server R. But that's not really the point. The only interest what we have is that we can have an ordering of our transactions. And what we do is each time a transaction accesses an object, then basically it assigns its timestamp to it. And therefore, in that sense, when here an object is accessed by the transaction, then the timestamp of the object is basically assigned to the object as the last access. And therefore, when we have the situation that we have a timestamp with a transaction, a timestamp on the object, and we do an access, if this transaction or this timestamp is before that one, then we know, okay, this is an access, a late access, and we abort it. Otherwise, we allow the access of it. And the timestamp, basically, when we have an access here, access the object, and we would say here, timestamp from object, we would assign it here it's equal t trans when we access it. And that's the way how we keep track to which transaction accessed the whole thing as the latest. And therefore, in that sense, we can very easily figure out when we aborted or when we basically can then later on can commit the transaction. But that's rather easy. And if we have the same time, that we have the same local timestamp here and there, we can basically use the server ID. And because each server ID is the IP address, which is unique, therefore we get a unique ordering again. And in that sense, the timestamp allows you a unique ordering of transactions. And that's all what we want to have. That's timestamp ordering. The other thing is what do you know from databases? You can have the situation that basically a transaction locks an object, accesses it, and then later on, prior to termination, the transaction basically removes all its object locks. And therefore, you have no interference of transactions. And that's the goal of the serialization of transactions, that you don't have any interference of transactions. Here, each server locks its own data items, objects. When a transaction tries to access it, it requests a lock, and you can distinguish between read and write locks. Read locks could mean that multiple read locks are allowed and only one write lock. And in that sense here, when you lock it, when a transaction accesses an object, it locks it before. It does not lock it when it's already locked. And except if the locks coexist, like multiple read locks, and when it terminates, then it removes the locks. Two-phase transactions are basically, you have one phase, that's a so-called locking phase, and then you have something like the release phase. During release, you don't have any locking anymore. And therefore, in that sense, you don't have a mixture between locking and release, locking and release. And the last approach for isolation is optimistic concurrency control. And the point here is, let me check. The point here is that the assumption is conflicts don't really happen or very rarely, and therefore you don't make any concurrency control. The assumption is nothing will happen. The probability is rather low. And you could actually check for conflicts in a way that you assign the time when it was accessed, and then in the same way as the timestamps, and then you could detect accesses by later transactions, and then you can decide what to do. Examples in the distributed applications, like if you look Dropbox, most of the people you should know what Dropbox are, file backup, file sharing, of files and folders, and you can access them from anywhere. You can also use it for sharing things. It uses optimistic concurrency control. It's basically on the file granularity. And there is also a way, it has a version history, and it also can detect if you had if you have two users making concurrent accesses. The first write is successful, the second write is basically rejected. And but it's no locking or something like that. Wikipedia, it's managing or creating managing wiki pages. Here you have something similar as with Dropbox. It's optimistic concurrency control for editing, reading. Certainly you can do anytime when you want. And here again, the first write is accepted. The second write basically an edit conflict screen is shown, and then the user can decide how to resolve the conflict. And Google Docs, that's something like a word processor instead of Word from Microsoft. It's basically the word processor in the network. And here the point is they have something like an awareness-based concurrency control. In that sense, if two people edit the same document simultaneously, they can see the other's cursor or the other's movement. And in that sense, you can see if other people are active on the same document, and then you can decide as an individual user if you want to do the modification or not. If you already see that your friend is working on that part. There, the awareness basically is shown on the character level, or if you have a spreadsheet, it's on a cell level. And therefore, in that sense, you also don't do any locking and things like that. It's more like an awareness-based concurrency control. The next thing is atomicity and persistence. Here, atomicity and persistence, you have more or less two approaches. You always have to think of it. You have the two endings, commit or abort. And therefore, you have to handle that two situations. And the atomicity, you have two options, intention list and new version. And when you have the situation here, like an object, then and a transaction accesses the object, then this transaction basically generates something like a log. And in that log, it writes all the modifications performed by transactions are written into, done on that object. And if a transaction then, if you have a second transaction here, trans one, also accessing this object, you also have an intention list. If you have locks, then, well, this one won't be generated, won't be created, because with the lock, you would already block that transaction out of it. and it would not get in. But if you have optimistic concurrency control, then you would have the situation that you have two concurrent transactions manipulating that object. And the modifications from trans 1 are appended here, and the modifications of this transaction are listed here. And each time an access occurs, all the operations are done to get the current state of the object. Because the point is, if you think of it, if this transaction overwrites the integer variable, first you had 5 in it here. I mean, here the value is 5, and then it overwrites it and writes 10 in it. And therefore, in that sense, when it does a renewed access, then it wants to get 10 and not really 5. This one, when it's accessed, it gets 5 and then possibly changes it to 7. And then it wants always to get 7. Therefore, in that sense, each access to that object requires to replay all the operations to get the current state of the object. And when you have then afterwards, when you have the commit and that's successful, you replay all the operations, and then at the end you have the current state in it. If this one runs into the situation that it's aborted, then basically the only thing what you do is you throw the intention list away. And you don't really modify anything from the object. New version is something pretty similar. You have the transaction 1, you have the transaction 2, you have the original object, you make a copy of it, of that object. This one gets a copy of it, and all the operations done here on this object, all the modifications or manipulations are done on this copy, and then when it's successful, then basically this one goes over to become the official object, and this one goes away. If this one is here aborted, then basically you throw that away. And therefore, in that sense, it's very easy to handle here the atomicity, because you can very easily handle commits and aborts. And you don't really have to redo, in the sense, to roll back. Because here, if you do all the changes, you would have to roll back and things like that. And that's you don't really have to deal with. The last thing is, for distributed transactions, certainly an important part of it is commit. And we can say separate commits, as you hear, separate commits on all involved servers is not sufficient. Therefore, what you need is something like a distributed commit. And that's the thing what happens with the two-phase commit protocol. And you can distinguish between the two phases, something like a voting phase and a completion phase. And the voting phase, all the involved servers vote if they want to, are they prepared to commit or not. And in a completion phase, then basically the commit is done or the abortion is done. And if we look at the two steps here, let's look at the example here. You have a client, and that client basically we had, and it sent requests here, sent requests here, and sent requests here. And a trivial example would be also something like, well, a wedding officer. If you have two people want to marry, then it's necessary that basically both involved people say yes. If one says no, then no wedding will take place. And the wedding is basically aborted. And you have the same situation here. All the involved servers must be ready to commit. And if we look at the interaction, first you have the situation, who is the coordinator? The coordinator is typically the client initiating the transaction. And you could also have a separate coordinator, but let's have it simple. We take the client having started the transaction. And after all the requests are handled and finished, then basically, and the client is in a phase that it wants to commit, then it sends something like the coordinator sends a message to all the involved servers, can commit, can you commit? And now the servers have to decide if they are ready to commit or not. If a server here is not ready to commit, it would basically vote no. And then it would send a no back to the client. Additionally, the server SK could immediately abort the transaction. Therefore, it does not have to wait for the outcome if the transaction is committed successfully or aborted, because it knows it voted no. Therefore, in that sense, that a transaction has to be aborted anyway. And therefore, in that sense, it can already release all its resources, can possibly throw away the intention lists it manages, can throw away the new versions and so on. It can basically eliminate all the traces of the transaction, the local traces. If it's ready, it voted yes. I mean, it could also send a yes back. That's what I mentioned here, that if there exists only one server, then basically the transaction is aborted, and this one would send then an abort message to all the servers which voted yes. It does not send an abort message to the servers which voted no, because they already eliminated everything. They don't really wait for an answer. Therefore, in that sense, this is sent only to all servers who voted ready. Let's assume all the servers voted yes. And then the transaction could be committed, and then it sends a commit message to all the servers, and then they basically can commit the transaction, and afterwards they send something like an acknowledgement that they performed the commit. The point is here, if you think of this situation, if this one voted yes, there is no way that this server could decide a little bit later and say, no, I don't really want to commit. I want to vote no. It cannot really take the vote back. It has to stick with its yes. And this also means that if this server crashes immediately after it sent the yes, and if the server comes up again and they're running, it has to be basically check if it has still open commits. Because therefore, in that sense, this yes has to be stored in a stable storage. And even if the server crashes, it must be, all that information must be available again at startup. When it comes back, then it possibly has to contact the client and say and ask, well, what happened with this transaction? If it was aborted, certainly it can eliminate everything else, the transaction. If it was committed, then it has to perform the commit. And it has the reason of it. If all the yes comes, this one would make a commit. And if one server is not available, we can't really have something like a partial commit. Commit here, and not a commit here because the server is not available anymore. The commit has to be done. And even if the server has crashed. The operations, what we have available here is some of it already mentioned. Can commit, that's the question from the coordinator to all the participants, if they're ready to commit. This here is a do commit from the coordinator to tell the participants to do the commit. Do abort is the equivalent. Then have committed, that's a question called from the participant to or a call from the participant to confirm that it has committed. And also here, get decision. That's the situation that possibly this message was lost in the network transmission, or the server has crashed and it did not receive the message and it was lost. And therefore it asks, well, what was the outcome? Here you see it once more from the example here, can commit, then here do a ready commit, yes, then here you do a cool commit and then have committed. And in the sense of if you have n servers involved, you have 4 times n messages for the commit. Additionally, you have all the requests going back and forth. And there are certain problems, and there the extensions. Situations. The problems which might be considered, a server can crash, the coordinator can crash. And that could mean that you have blocking situations in the sense of the coordinator waits for the commit acknowledge of the server. The server waits for the final decision because the client or the coordinator has crashed. Therefore, in that sense, there's a blocking of each other. And we have an extended two-phase commit protocol. And here it's the coordinator, and here is basically one server, and that's done then by every server. The coordinator makes a multicast, ready or can commit, and then it waits. The server receives a message, can commit. If it's okay to commit, then it saves the data in a persistent store. Also hier not lost at server crash. And that's what I meant, what I already said before. And then it replies, okay, this one collects everything. If all okay, then it logs the outcome in a table that's again in a persistent store. And then it sends the commit to all of them. If it gets the commit, makes the commit, and sends the acknowledgement. And here it collects the acknowledgements, and then it garbage collects the outcomes table. The point is here, if they abort, certainly it deletes the persistent storage. Here, after the failure, for example, these are the additional part of it. The additional part. After failure, for each pending protocol in the outcomes table, it waits for the, it sends the outcome again. Because it could be that this message was lost at one router. And then it waits for the acknowledgements again. Then here for a pending protocol, because it has here the persistent storage, after failure, it sends here, that's basically the message, get decision to figure out the outcome. And that's then it would perform either the abort or the commit, depending what the decision was. In that sense, we can say we have to handle things with persistent storage on the client's, on the coordinator side, and on the server side. And then we can handle certain or most of the errors on the on server or coordinator crashes. There exists even an additional three-phase commit. You would have something like what you have also sometimes in politics, in the parliament, that you remember if you go, if you sometimes follow a parliament, that they would have something like a pre-vote. And it's not really a really vote. It's something like a pre-vote to figure out if all if they get a majority or not. And here you would have something like a similar things. You would ask a can commit, and then you would send something like a pre-commit to figure out if they're really ready for the commit. And then they do a pre-commit. They send the acknowledgement that they would do have done the pre-commit. And then they get the message to really perform the commit. Similar like in Parliament when the real vote comes then after the pre-vote situation. Good, that's that. And one thing what we can look at a distributed deadlock, because then also what we have here is the situation that multiple transactions can run into a deadlock. And if you know from operating systems, if you have multiple processes accessing the multiple resources, then if you do it in a wrong way, they use the resources, then you could have, I don't know, if you remember the situation that you have a process 1, a process 2, you have a resource 1, You have a resource 2. This one wants resource 1. This one has resource 1. This one wants resource 2. And this one has resource 2. Therefore, in that sense, this one has to be drawn in this way. Exactly that. The error was wrong because it's a cycle. Therefore, I was confused. I didn't see a cycle anymore. In that sense here, this one has it, or this one wants it, this one has it. This one, it wants the resource, this one has it. Therefore, you have a cycle here, and therefore you have a wait. This one waits for this process, and this process wants for this here. And that's, you can also have the situation that you could have something like a wait for, and this is also what's called a wait for graph. And we could also have a wait for graph in a sense that we have the resources, objects, and we have the transactions instead of processes. Here we can say here the object A is held by transaction U. U waits for B. B is held by V. V waits for C. And C is held by W. And W waits for object A. Therefore, you have now here these three transactions. You have these three objects. And here this object D is held by U, but it's not a problem. Nobody else is waiting for it. And therefore, in that sense, you have here a wait for graph with waits and held by. And the theory is the following, that you could construct something like a global wait for graph from all the local wait for graphs on all involved servers. Certainly, the problem is it's a single point of failure, the central server, because it's constructed by a single server. So here, constructed by a single server. If that single server is not available, then nothing goes on. And then the communication between servers take time. And that could be that, for example, this server notifies, let's say, our central, that's our central server here, notifies here this server of the current situation that we have a held by relationship with object A. Sense that. This let's say that it could be that actually this it sends here in the meantime this transaction committed and finished, and therefore it released this this held by. And therefore, in that sense, here you have a wait for situation, but it's not really a real wait for anymore, and you end up with something called phantom deadlocks. This server detects a deadlock because it has here this wait for relationship and this held by. But this actually does not exist anymore because in the meantime, this transaction committed and finished. And therefore, in that sense, you really don't have a cycle anymore. But because it takes time, you have a transmission of the messages, and therefore, in that sense, a central server is not a real good idea. We have a second approach, and that's what we call here this edge chasing. And this works in a way you have no global wait for graph. Each involved server basically manages its own local knowledge, and the servers, and we can say all the servers, try to find cycles. And here what you do is each server forwards messages or sends probes, and they consist of wait for relationships, of wait for relationships in the probes, and each distribution basically its distributed transaction starts at the server, and that's basically the coordinator for T. That means the coordinators for the different transactions might be very different. And the coordinator basically tracks whether the transaction is active or waiting on a particular object. And the lock manager each object has a lock manager, or you have a, or let's say and therefore usually the lock manager of a server manages the information if it's locked or not. And the edge chasing works as following. Here, that's the situation, and the red basically means that's the new situation. W wants to access the object A. Here, the server X knows that object A is already locked by the transaction U. Therefore, it sends the information to the coordinator. It sends a probe to the coordinator of U. And what it has in it, it says W waits for U, because here W waits for U. Then here we have the situation U waits for B. And in that sense, because that's the coordinator of U knows that. And it goes to the lock manager of B. It knows that V uses the object here, and therefore it takes the probe W waits for U and appends V to it. Therefore, it sends here W waits for U for V is sent by the coordinator, and that goes to C. And C has the lock manager knows that it's held by W, and therefore it appends here W, and now you see you have a cycle, and W waits for U, for V, and for W, and that means you have a deadlock detected, and we're soon finished. And what happens now here is that now you start with a resolution, and in that sense, the one of the transaction is basically aborted. For example, V or U or W is aborted, and then basically the held by information. If U is aborted, then basically that held by link is broken. And the last thing is what I wanted to show at the end, because here you might run into a problem. And the point is here, same situation. Here you have an initial situation. V waits for this object, which is occupied by T. T wants A, which is occupied by U. U waits for that. And that's occupied by W. And W wants B. Therefore, in that sense, we have the situation. Here is a deadlock detected. I mean, here starts initial situation. You start initialization here. Also init here. You would start here one, and you start here an init. That means you start two initialization. And therefore, in that sense, you detect a deadlock here, and you detect a deadlock here, depending if you start at A or if you start at B. That means here. You go here, and now you have the situation. This one detected a deadlock, and this one detected a deadlock. It's the same deadlock. And when you perform it, that would mean this one would decide and break a link, and this one would decide and break a link. And if you are unlucky, this one would decide and kill W, and this one would decide and kill V. And therefore, you would kill two transactions, but actually it would be sufficient to have one, because then the cycle is already broken. And how you can do that? You can assign priorities to each transaction, and each transaction gets a priority, and you have a total ordering of the transactions. And if you detect a link here, basically the detection here, they know all the transactions involved. They take the transaction with the lowest priority. Here, the same thing, take the transaction with the lowest priority. That's, for example, W. Then this one comes to the decision of W, this one comes to the decision of W, and therefore only one transaction is eliminated, aborted, and then the deadlock is broken, and then we can continue on. And that's how I want to end up here, because that's all it's basically a distributed deadlock detection, which is basically distributed to all involved servers. You have no central unit, and therefore in that sense you have not a single point of failure. You have no communication delay. You have communication, but that causes no delay, and no delay in the sense of ending up with phantom locks. Thank you very much, and then we see us